this meeting of the House Military Veterans Affairs Committee to order. It is now 1:32 p.m., Thursday, January 24th. We are in the State Capitol, Gruenberg Room 120. Present, we have Vice Chair Ledoux, Representative Parrish, Representative Sadler, Representative Sponholz, and Representative Rauscher. And let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. And President also is Representative Tuck. Gets that into that in there. Let's start with a little bit of housekeeping. Make sure you have your phones on, not only on, make sure it's on silent. And take it off vibrate, if you will, because it can still interfere with our electronic devices. I would also like to thank Caitlin Ellis with the House Records and Kelsey Goodell, who is moderating the meeting, and our committee aide, Kendra Kloster. Okay, so at our last meeting on Tuesday, I brought up a point to correct some procedures that we haven't been following in the past, but I would think that it's important that we do start following proper procedures. And I wanted to give people time to think about that procedure, and that is allowing the chair to draft and submit committee bills on behalf of the whole committee. And we do have some coming forward from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to bring Title 26 reforms, which I really do prefer to do as a committee bill rather than making it personal legislation that we're all involved in that. So the standard procedure, the procedure in the past, really has been allowing the committee chair to do that, but I think it's really proper to have a vote on that. So with that, is there any discussions?
Would you like me to move this?
I just want to see if anybody... Yeah. Okay, in that case, real quick.
Under discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do appreciate that offer, and I was the person, who, a member who raised the objection last week, or yesterday, was it 2 days ago? 2 days ago, and I would respectfully ask that we, if you'd like to make one of your bills or any bill that comes before the committee, a committee bill, that we allow the chance to vote and determine the committee's will on that and not have a blanket, you know, unanimous consent for that. With respect, thank you.
Okay, and we got a little bit ahead of ourselves. Representative Ledoux.
Would you let me make the motion?
Yes, please.
Thank you. I move and ask unanimous consent that Representative Tuck, the Chair of Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, be delegated the duties and responsibilities in AS24.08.060 paren A and paren during regular and special sessions of the 30th Alaska State Legislature. This delegation remains in effect until withdrawn by the committee.
Is there an objection?
I object.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Sadler. And would you like to speak again, or?
Yes, for the record, in the proper place. Yes, AS24.08.060 subparagraphs referenced remain in effect regardless of what this committee does or says about them. And I think they do offer the proper deference to the committee to decide for itself what the status of each bill that comes before it should be. Certainly, Mr. Chairman, you're free to make that motion or have one of your members make that motion. I would respectfully request and respectfully will retain the authority to object to that, and let the will of the committee be expressed in an individual vote on a bill-by-bill basis.
Thank you, Representative Sadler, and I just want to let everybody know that it is my intention to keep everybody included and informed on what's going on ahead of time so that members aren't caught off guard when bills get introduced. Any further discussion? Representative Ledoux.
Yeah, I guess I would just like to point out two things. Number one, everybody will have a chance to vote on any bill which comes before this committee. So if there's an objection to a bill, even a committee bill, one would have the opportunity to object and a roll call vote would be held. Number two, I would like to point out that as long as I have been in the legislature, committee chairmen have always introduced bills, and they've introduced those bills without going and asking the committee for permission to do so. And all this does is clarifies it and does it in the actual way that it should have been done for years.
Any further discussions? Okay, as a matter of efficiency, I would like the ability to do so. And since there is an objection, and the objection remains, we'll take a roll call vote.
Objection remains.
Brief timeout.
Okay, brief at ease.
One more time, could you explain what we're voting on?
We're voting on giving the chair permission to go ahead and start drafting legislation on behalf of the committee. The legislation that's going to be coming forward are some Title 26 changes that are coming from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, some cleanup bills. And so rather than making it personal legislation, I would like to spread the honor and have it be a committee bills as we go forward, but I need permission to start moving forward on that.
Follow up question?
Yes. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Chair. So then everybody votes on this draft that...
No, in this case, we're not going to see drafts until allowed the permission for me to start drafting that on behalf of the committee. I mean, I could...
I don't mean to start drafting, but on the finished product.
Oh, yeah, the finished product. Well, no, I'll be conferring with offices, make sure it's going in the right direction that everybody wants to do. I'm going to include everybody as much as possible so that when the bill is introduced, everybody understands what its intent is and they will feel comfortable moving forward with it.
Chair?
Representative Rauscher.
Follow-up question? Would it be all right through the chair to ask the gentleman from the representative from Anchorage to state the objection again, the purpose of the objection to me?
Yes. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My objection is that you're essentially seeking approval of a pig in a poke. You give us some general description of what bills you're offering or plan to offer at the request of the Commissioner of Military and Veterans Affairs, but before the members get a chance to see that draft, you're asking for the authority from all the members to make them committee bills. I think that's certainly you can make that request, and I certainly offer my objection to it. I certainly think we'll take up each of the bills, and if you wish to make them committee bills, I would appreciate if you put that motion forward, and we'll consider each bill on its merits.
Any other further discussion?
Yes, Representative Ledoux. I'm wondering whether I can ask the representative from Egon River whether he did it that way when he was chair of the Resources Committee, whether he asked permission of anybody else before he introduced a bill as a committee bill, just for curiosity's sake.
Representative Sadler.
We can certainly go back and look at the record.
Okay, any further discussions? Okay, I'm going to close discussion. House Records, would you please take the roll call?
Representative Reinbold, absent. Representative Sponholz.
Yes.
Representative Ledoux.
Yes.
Representative Parrish.
Yes.
Representative Rauscher.
Qualifying my answer, I don't know why there's the big difference here, but I'm just going to vote with Representative Sadler just because I don't know.
Okay, we're no longer under discussion, so
I'm
yes
sorry.
Or no answer.
Yes.
You can defer or yes or no.
Okay, hang on. Void the roll.
I voted. I'm sorry.
Void the roll. Let's start over again, please.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Yes, our records clerk, please go ahead and take the roll.
Yes. Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Reinbold is absent. Representative Sponholz.
Yes.
Representative Ledoux.
Yes.
Representative Parrish.
Yes.
Representative Rauscher.
No.
Representative Tuck.
Yes.
4 yeas, 2 nays.
Okay, so with a vote of 4 yeas, 2 nays, the motion does pass. Moving on. The next order of business that we have before us today is House Bill 3. It's the reemployment rights for National Guard members. As sponsor of the bill, I would like to offer some introductory remarks and then move on to public testimony. We do have people that are going to be testifying that need to leave by a certain time, so I really want to be mindful of their time and make sure they have an opportunity to testify today. We also have representatives of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Department of Labor, and Workforce Development, and we have Department of Defense for testimony available for questions. All right, now House Bill 3. House Bill 3 seeks to correct the deficiency that we have in our employment practices with Alaskans who are serving in the National Guard across the nation. This bill is a nationwide effort by the Department of Defense to ensure those who serve their nations for all 50 states when called to duty, regardless of their service location, will have reemployment rights to their Alaskan civilian job after completing the various critical duties when called by a governor for state active duty. The National Guard is a hybrid state-federal entity. While National Guard members are subject to federal call of duty by the President of the United States, They can also be called up for the state active duty by the governor in to respond to state emergencies such as fires, tornadoes, and floods. The Federal Law Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act, USERRA, protects members of the Army and Air National Guard when they are called away from their civilian jobs for federal service. However, USERRA does not apply when a National Guard member must leave their job for state active duty. If National Guard members are to have reemployment rights and after state active duty, it must be changed through state law. Alaska currently has a law that applies to employment protections to the public and private employees. However, it is explicitly limited to the members of the Alaska National Guard. There are several Alaska residents who serve in the National Guard of other states who do not have the reemployment protections for their own employment. By passing House Bill 3, we will extend the employment protections to Alaskans who are serving in any National Guard. The Department of Defense has identified this legislation as a key quality of life issue and is actively seeking to make this policy change across the nation in all 50 states. So far, 28 states have done so. They passed similar legislation, and three other states are now taking it up this session in addition to Alaska. So how many Alaskans would fall into this category? Department of Defense has identified in their most recent data call that there are 33 of some 4,800 Alaska Guardsmen who self-reported where they work. Keep in mind that since this is known by self-reporting, the number could be much higher because some may have chosen not to report where they serve. While the great majority of these people are in the Alaska Guard, there are those who self-reported serving for various reasons for other states' tags. So these guardsmen serve in 19 states total, and some had put down unknown. And with that, I would like to open it up to public testimony. And online, off net, we have Mark Sansucci with the Department of Defense. Mr. Sansucci, are you available?
Yes, Honorable Chair Tuck and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to provide the information in support of House Bill 3. You just encapsulated the essence of
Mr. Sansucci, if you don't mind stating your name and affiliation for the record, please, and then go ahead and proceed.
Yes, I'm sorry. Mark Sansucci, I'm a retired Air Force officer and presently the Department of Defense Regional State Liaison for the Northwest, which includes Alaska, and I work for the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Military Community Policy. I apologize for that. Chair Tuck, pretty much synopsized that 28 states have done this already, 3 are taking it up. 33 have self-reported that they are in other states, and I would like to beg your indulgence to read the states, because when I looked at it, I was aghast, because you would think, okay, you live in Alaska, maybe Washington, you know, Idaho. There are guardsmen serving in Alabama, Arkansas, California, Florida, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Missouri, Montana, North Carolina, North Dakota, Nevada, New York, Oregon, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Washington, and even West Virginia, and two other ones didn't report. So there are people, and some would say, well, that's not very many, but I guess we would kind of argue that even if it's 5, it's worth legislation with a zero fiscal note to help improve the policy so these folks wouldn't be subject to getting fired if they worked in private employment or any other place. So I don't want to be redundant, so that's what I would ask. Thank you for the consideration, and I stand for questions.
Is there any questions from committee members? Representative Ledoux.
Yes, Mr. Sansucci. I'm just wondering, is there any sort of reciprocity between one National Guard unit and another, that if you are a member of the National Guard in one place and you move, that you can transfer your National Guard position to the state that you've moved in? Move to?
Representative Ledoux. I'm not aware of that, and for National Guard, and I'm a retired active duty person, so I'm not an expert on this, but in National Guard, the states are almost sovereigns in that they have their own respective organizations, and so when somebody tries to move from one state to another, it's based on the job and the rank And so a major who's in Oregon would have to, would have to find a job in Alaska as a major, a specific job. So I've never heard of anything called reciprocity as it relates to people moving from one state to another within the National Guard organization. So I'm sorry, I can't answer beyond that other than they're very unique in internal organizations in among the states where internal promotions and jobs are created, and no, I'm not aware of reciprocity as I think I understand you're asking the question.
Thank you.
Any other further questions for Mr. Sensucci? Thank you so much for your testimony. I really appreciate it. If you don't mind staying on the line in case we have some questions, if you're able to, down the road.
Mr. Chair, I'm available. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Are there any others online or in the audience that would like to testify? Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole. If you don't mind stating your name and affiliation again. Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Dole. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the State of Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Mr. Chairman, members of the House Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs, I'm the Deputy Commissioner. I'm also a retired National Guard Colonel with 3 decades of service in the Army and Air National Guard Reserves and active duty. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today. I think it's helpful just for a quick background for those who haven't grown up with the National Guard to look at the different duty types and some of the other duty statuses there. The true source of the military in the United States, the military that made this great nation, is the militia. The federal forces came along later on. However, the Air and Army Guard are now reserve components of the federal Army and Air Force that provide the bulk of our funding. Typically, the National Guard is under the control of the governor while organizing training and equipping for federal missions. I'm going to give a quick background on the 3 big duty types that may assist in this discussion as we go farther. First, that service under the command of the governor is under United States Code Title 32. That is to organize, train, and equip for federal missions and go forth and do things when needed by the government. The federal government. In that role, each state has has certain structure and certain positions. To go back to that question, it's called an interstate transfer. So that if I meet the requirements to be an armor officer in Wisconsin, where I became an armor officer, I've gone to Fort Knox, Kentucky. I've met the Army qualifications for that career field. When I move to another state, if they have an armor officer opening at my rank, I am qualified for that, can transfer into it. We call it an interstate transfer, or IST, and I am going to try to minimize the acronyms in this. Normally, that process can take 6 to 8 months, just in terms of the migration of the systems from one military to another. So there's a common recognition if you have completed the military training, you can go to another state that has an opening for that military training in rank or career field. So that is available, and that's key and pivotal to the Alaska National Guard for going forward, as I'll explain shortly. For operational uses, such as the president calling us up to go to Iraq or Afghanistan to send our members there, or other national needs, that's pursuant to Title 10 United States Code. Like Title 32, the individuals are paid for by the federal government. The third area, and the area that this legislation pertains to, the only one, is for response to state disaster or other needs for reporting to the governor. Under state active duty, the state pays the bill, the state commands them, the state decides what they're going to do, how they're going to do it. And that's the area this bill pertains to. There's federal protections for the first two under Title 32 to organize, train, and equip, and Title 10 to go to war. It's the state active duty for disaster response that we're talking about here today. Today, most often the use of state active duty in Alaska is for disaster response that exceeds civilian capacity. We're not going to bring the Guard in this role unless it's something the civilian capacity can't do. Wildland firefighting was a potential use that we have done about every other year we have brought Guardsmen forward. A few years ago, it was snow shoveling in Cordova. Other states have broader uses where they use state active duty. Southeast states every year seem to put tens of thousands of guardsmen into state active duty in hurricane season to address the needs there of preparedness for that. Many states will use state active duty when they have a particularly need, such as an investigating officer for critical experience. When I first enlisted in the Wisconsin Army National Guard, the state active duty use included patrolling roads to help in blizzards, sandbagging for floods, wildland firefighting, running the prisons during a corrections officer strike to that there'd be someone in there to run them, manning checkpoints during a period of civil disturbance, and assisting with security after areas were ravaged by tornadoes. So it's completely up to the governor and what role they're going to use it then. Again, though, that there's no federal protections where they're in that role. They're solely by state. State active duty can be lengthy. If we look after Katrina, there were individuals that were in state active duty for months. Typically, though, it's 5 days or less, probably 99% of the time, and probably 3 days or less for the typical blizzard or tornado response, which is the bulk of the time when you're going to use state active duty on a numerical basis. Wanted to talk briefly about how it comes to be that you would live in Alaska and go across the nation to serve elsewhere. It seems counterintuitive, after all, given the cost and difficulty of getting there. Realize when you go to drill or train in another state for your drill weekends, you as a guardsman pay that bill and you take that time. That isn't paid for by the federal government. It basically happens when your military career is out of sync with your civilian, professional, or personal life, and is usually temporary. Some examples that come to mind are students, Alaskans, who go outside to study, and they can't afford to come back every weekend to drill in Alaska, so they transfer outside. Military spouses, when the military spouse comes to J-Bear or Eielson or Wainwright, military spouses frequently were active duty and left active duty, so they only have one spouse deployed at a time. That spouse then will develop a military affiliation with a guard unit outside and will. But in the, and when they come up here, they're still affiliated and haven't transferred yet. Or jobs where a good chunk of your time is outside, but you're in Alaska. And airline pilots are a great example of that. It can also happen for professional reasons. We're a small state with limited force structure. So if you want to serve in career fields you served in active duty and we don't have up here in the National Guard, such as you're an F-15 pilot and an F-16 pilot, an armor officer, air defense artillery, service in another state allows you to participate in a career field you know and love rather than flying a different metal up here or doing different things up here, which you could retrain for, but you can also continue to serve outside there. It also, for us, where we have individuals who transfer to another state, it gives them opportunities to serve in positions that we don't have because we are a relatively small state. For instance, humanitarian response forces are about 3,000 people. The one for the Northwest is based in Oregon. If you want one of the senior positions and that above the captain level, you got to be in Oregon. So if you drill in Oregon, even though you're an Alaskan, you can transfer to the Oregon Guard, get that upper level expertise and operating a large force for a mass disaster, and bring that back to you when you transfer back to the Alaska National Guard when you complete those career development things, I guess. Personally, there are three times in my life where my military career was out of sync with my civilian life, and I found myself in this kind of situation. I was an armor officer through college. After graduating college, I moved to another state for a job. I continued to drill in my original state. If I'd been called up to state active duty in my original state, I'd have been in the position this bill calls for. That was easy, though. It was in the Midwest, and the border was 40 miles away with a highway gang there. When I got off active duty and went into law school, after finishing law school, I continued to affiliate with a reserve organization where I was flying C-12s in the Midwest, even though I was living in D.C., because the organization was getting ready for some key restructuring that was important, and I wanted to be there to guide the unit through it. So for every weekend, one weekend a month, as well as for additional time for going out to meet my flying proficiency blocks, I paid for my own ticket to fly from D.C. to Chicago and then to go operate the aircraft there, command the unit there. And when I moved to Alaska, I continued to travel to Newport News, Virginia to command a unit and maintain pilot proficiency while seeking a position up here, because there has to be an opening before we can bring you into the National Guard, and making that transition. The U.S. spent well into six figures for my pilot training and the follow-on courses to get me where I was. And were I to take a break in that flying until I could complete was an eight-month process to get in here, the U.S. would have spent somewhere well into five figures to regain the proficiency in flying hour time. Helicopters are expensive to operate, as a side note there. I'd add a personal note in what that looks like. Cross-country affiliation may be common outside, particularly on the East Coast, where you can drive across three states in an hour. But from Alaska, the time, distance, and cost factors of an outside National Guard affiliation highly incentivize finding a path to the Alaska National Guard or the Federal Air or Army Reserves up here. It just, it's a tremendous cost and tremendous pain trying to drill across the nation from Alaska. Because that turns into a temporary factor up here, folks that come up here realize it sucks going to the East Coast one weekend a month just for your drill weekend. We're going to bag those folks in the Alaska National Guard if they want to continue their affiliation, and that's why DMVA supports this bill as overall conducive to developing a professional militia in Alaska. This bill would allow continuity of service for those Alaskans whose life plans require them to spend time outside, the student or the professional pilot or other person who finds themselves outside more than in Alaska. It incentivizes new Alaskans to remain engaged with the military from a prior affiliation and their readiness kept current by continuing until we can find a position for them in the Alaska National Guard and line up training as necessary if we don't have the same job. It also supports us developing and fielding a more capable force for Alaska by capitalizing on those out-of-state positions we just can't replicate up here, letting Alaskans go out for a finite period and come back. When they're out on that period, there would be a period of risk for their job up here, where they're called to state active duty up here. And for the new Alaskans that came up here who just started on a civilian job, there would also be that risk were they to continue the affiliation outside. In short, Alaska may have a transient population, but we're confident we'll gain or regain those Alaskans affiliated with another state's National Guard, given the challenges of time, distance, and cost of outside affiliation. This bill increases their recruitability and retainability by avoiding breaks in service and their readiness when they do come to us, maintaining or increasing their ability to serve Alaskans in time of disaster, all Americans in time of war when mobilized, and also saving taxpayers the high cost of either retraining them back up to proficiency or they're deciding to just separate altogether and are training someone brand new from scratch and the taxpayer picking up that cost. I know I must have had some jargon and acronyms slide in here. My apologies. General Hummel normally puts an acronym jar out we have to pay into if we did that. I recognize this is a complex area. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them to the best of my ability.
Any questions? Representative Ledoux, Representative Rauscher, and Representative Sadler.
I was just going to try to find out, is it usually one weekend a month that somebody goes for drill activities?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, typically outside units have an expectation that you go one weekend a month plus at least a two-week training period. After the war on terrorism, those periods have become more frequent many times for additional training required. But the typical standard obligation is that one weekend a month and then another two-week annual training period.
And then just to follow up on that.
Follow up.
So if you're doing something like, let's say, riot control, Would that be federalized or would that be state?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, normally riot control would be under state active duty. The one time I can think of where it was in 1963 when the Governor Wallace had his National Guard taken from him when it was mobilized and it was put in a federal role to maintain law and order, but all the other times I can think of, it's been state active duty.
Thank you.
Representative Rauscher.
Chairman, is this a time where I could speak to the bill itself, or do you want me to actually talk to, ask a question to the witness?
Well, right now we're in public testimony, so if you don't mind just doing to your testifiers. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the military abbreviation JAR abbreviated MAJ?
Chair Representative Sadler, we haven't had the courage to come up with a abbreviation for the military abbreviation chart yet.
Lightness aside, I do have some serious questions. Through the chair, Mr. Dole, this seems to actually, in my understanding, might reduce the pressure you might have on somebody who's on interstate transfer from Minnesota or someplace if you allow them to maintain a lower risk to their private employment. Back in Minnesota, for example, by passing this bill, they're less likely to want to train for or fit into a slot in the Alaska National Guard. Am I understanding that correctly? Or?
Through the chair, we acknowledge this removes one basis to incentivize their coming to the Alaska National Guard. However, we feel that for the person who wants to maintain a military affiliation, the cost and inconvenience and greater risk to their job from additional time necessary on the front and back end of the drill weekend to drill outside offsets that, and overall they will want to come to Alaska. This helps keep them just wanting to be involved with the military till they can affiliate with the Alaska National Guard for that new Alaskan or the person they affiliated and came up here.
And that opens the door for my follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler.
So is an interstate transfer only temporary? I understand it seems to be they want to accommodate the guardsman who moves to a different state and wants to maintain the affiliation with the guard, and that's a good thing. It's a desirable end. But is that open-ended, or is there a time limit during which that interstate transfer can be valid?
The Chair, Representative Sadler, an interstate transfer is permanent. You have just changed your affiliation. Okay. You were a Wisconsin guardsman. Now you are an Alaska guardsman forever.
Then I've used the wrong terminology. So how long?
Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. How long can somebody from this the chap from Minnesota serve in the Alaska Guard slot before he has to either fish or cut bait and join the Guard or get out of the Minnesota Guard?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, you can only be in one National Guard at a time. So in order to become a member of the Alaska National Guard, you would receive a conditional discharge or conditional release from the other National Guard saying we're releasing you of further obligations because you're affiliating with another National Guard, and that's spelled out by federal regulation. They have to do that.
I'm trying to answer the question to the member that left me. But how long could someone go without being discharged from their sending unit back in Minnesota and still serve in Alaska? How long could that go? Is there any time limit?
Through the chair, for a transfer, they cannot start as an Alaska Guardsman until they are done being a Minnesota Guardsman.
But I'm not being lawyerly, but so if they never want to let go of their Minnesota service and keep basically going back to drill weekends and their 2 weekends of summer, or 2 weeks of summer, is there any obligation for them to terminate that relationship?
The Chair, Representative Sadler, as long as their military duties can accommodate and their responsibilities to Minnesota can accommodate the longer response time that would be entailed for that position. In certain positions within the National Guard, you're required to be able to respond within a certain amount of time. When we have that earthquake, we need you here now, not in 3 days. For those positions, the state may impose a limit on how far away they could live, but by and large, there is no. That's a very subjective, position-specific issue. The overall answer to your question is no. You could stay. You could go to you retired in Alaska and continue to drill and affiliate with the Minnesota National Guard, even though it's a lesser organization, if you so chose.
Spoken like a true badger.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, I noticed that 28 other states have already passed similar legislation. 3 others are considering it. If Alaska were to adopt this, do you think it would help other states take that step as well? Peer pressure.
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, we are hopeful it would, because as a nation, the longer that we can keep individuals with a military affiliation until we can transfer them to another organization, if their life plans get them out of sync, the more we save as taxpayers in retraining new recruits off the street, the more we also gain as Americans in having folks with more experience and training when we do have to put them in harm's way. We think overall it would support that national effort, yes.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Mr. Representative Sandel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if this is an answer that the Deputy Commissioner can give, but one possible question you might not have gotten very high self-reporting is that the question about whether a Guard member who is residing, who's sleeping at night in Alaska, but serving in and out of the Alaska National Guard unit, whether or not they qualify for a permanent fund dividend, and their dependents and relatives would also qualify, or not qualify because they might be getting the benefits of residence elsewhere, might be a factor. And I guess the question I would ask the Department of Administration might be if there's any special scrutiny given those folks for permanent fund qualifications. But that's a future question.
Thank you, Representative Sather. That's outside the scope of this piece of legislation. Any other questions for our testifier? Okay.
Any other further testifiers in the audience or online?
Representative Sadler. I apologize. That's my other note. A brief question through the chairman to Mr. Dole. The language speaks in page 1, line 6 of the organized militia, and then on line 8 refers to National Guard. I do understand that the unorganized militia is every able-bodied male between 8 and 45. Who is the organized militia if it's not the National Guard?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, in Alaska, the organized militia constitutes the Air National Guard, the Army National Guard, Alaska Air National Guard, Alaska Army National Guard, the Alaska State Defense Force, and the Alaska Naval Militia. That language may vary from state to state. I understand under Alaska's Title 26, though, those are the four entities in it.
Thank you. Thanks for indulging, Mr. Chair.
Any other further questions from committee members? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony, Deputy Commissioner. Are there any other public members who would like to testify? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is closed. It is the chair's intent to make sure that we have two hearings on all our bills. I don't want to rush anything. Representative Rauscher, you have under discussion?
Yes, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much, for, Chairman Tuck. Government hires people. Private entity hires people. There's large and there's small companies. In today's economy, we have businesses that are slowly going out of business or downsizing, reducing personnel. And I was just wondering, in the bill, I see the requirement to hire back the person who is on duty, but if they can't afford to, if they're going out of business, I don't see anything addressed where occasions where they might not be able to do that. They're not hiring more people. They've had a temporary. They're probably going to lose the temporary in place of this. And I'm speaking because I want to support the bill, because I want to vote for it. But I'm just wondering, how is that addressed in the bill, and have I missed it?
Thank you for the question. And if I may, have our members from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, this is a reduction of force issue. And if there is a reduction of force that's going on with the company, how is that normally handled for returning guardsmen? Or if you can answer that question, if not, then I'll defer to either Sansucci online or Mr. Dole. And if you will, please state your name and affiliation for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Stephen Williams. I serve as an Employment Security Analyst 3 with the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and I currently serve there as the Statewide Veterans Coordinator, where I oversee veteran services at our Alaska job centers. I cannot answer that question as it pertains to this bill or to the current statute as it stands. But there is similar legislation or similar law under USERRA that was mentioned earlier this afternoon. And the Veterans Employment Training Service, as part of the U.S. Department of Labor, is responsible for investigating claims under USERRA. And the director of the Veterans Employment Training Service up here in Alaska could probably better answer your question as far as how it applies to employers who might be downsizing or going out of business.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative Rauscher?
If I could, through the chair, again, one more question. Line 1 and 2 on the second page. Proposed senior HB3, second page of the bill itself, line number 2, 1 and 2. At the pay, seniority and benefit level the employee would have had if the employee had not been absent as a result of the active state service or National Guard service in another state. So the temporary, he's coming back as a temporary, is that my understanding? His position was reduced to a temporary. And under the temporary guidelines for federal workers, any kind of workers under the federal guidelines, he's now making a part-time salary. I'm just wondering whether that's all taken care of in this or not. I'm just wondering how this all reads out and plays out. That's all. I'm sorry.
Okay, and then thank you for the question. It's actually an existing statute. The only thing that we're changing right now is just adding active guards service under the law of another state. So that's typically what happens already. But if I may, if I can bring the Deputy Commissioner Dole up to share how it currently works.
Through the chair, Representative Voucher, we have the Employee Support of the Guard and Reserve is a federal DOD program we affiliate with. Its state chair is a guy named Craig Campbell, who we know in another role here as the president of the CEO of Alaska Aerospace. We're going to clarify with ESGR, Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve, but we believe there's a minimum threshold on company size this applies to. What we have encountered, though, since the global war on terrorism, with deployers being gone for a year or 18 months, when they come back, the company is downsized. If a position no longer exists, you can't put them into it because it's impossible. So in that scenario, if the position is gone because of that downsizing, it removes the obligation to put them into that position because you can't. Either the company doesn't exist or the position doesn't. And we have encountered that through no fault of the service member, no fault of the company, just we know what the economy is doing.
Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, a follow-up through the chair. So if he's now a temporary, does that mean that the position that he left no longer exists? In other words, you've hired a temporary in his place, and does that mean that his position doesn't no longer exist? I'm just trying to follow where you went.
Through the chair, going back to the USERRA, we're talking the federal context or in this context, there's two scenarios there. One, the position doesn't exist. It isn't filled by a temporary employee either, just the company downsized and no longer has a role or need for someone doing that. In that case, under the existing law, there is no obligation to put someone back in a job that has been eliminated for business reasons. In the second example, companies traditionally will put somebody, when they bring in a replacement, they'll come in a temporary hire. For instance, when we have folks on active duty now, we get temporary PCNs to temporarily fill that AMIA team leader position until the guardsman gets back from whatever they're doing. In that situation, the replacement should come in with the understanding they're a temporary fill. For your typical state active duty that is 3 to 5 days, most companies are hard-pressed to advertise, hire, screen, and hire someone that time. The ideal solution is typically going to one of the temp manpower companies to get you that immediate fill, and they understand it's a temporary position you've contracted with their employer to provide them to you for. And we are going back to Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve to see if there's a minimum business size that the federal government uses for applicability of this.
Thank you very much.
And I don't know how long the existing language has been in our statutes. I'll look it up, but it's been already in practice for many, many years. Thank you. Representative Parrish?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair. It's my expectation that this will be a relatively small number. Heaven prevent disasters. It should be a relatively small number of people involved, and it's a section of law which has played out successfully across the nation for a number of years. I guess to speak to Representative Rusher's concern, how has it played out elsewhere? It seems all right, but
through the chair, Representative Parrish, the short version is we have no data where we're not aware of it, these provisions ever having been invoked. Our DOD representative may online. We do not. However, there's three relatively rare things that have to align for this to come into play. First, you have to have a person who is drilling in or affiliated with the National Guard of a different state from which they're a resident. Second, we're talking about 30-something folks versus 4,000 Alaska Guardsmen here. So we know that's a small part. Second, they have to be called to state active duty. State active duty is still relatively rare because it's pricey to most states. So it isn't something that happens frequently. Disasters do happen, and it may happen. And third, they have to have they have to be, it has to trigger a potential adverse action from an employer in Alaska. So for the student who's living outside, the Alaskan who's outside while they're going to school, they don't have a job up here. Mm-hmm. So we recognize that with those three things together, it's probably a pretty small set. I will defer to our DOD representative if he's aware, if it's ever been used.
And Mr. Santucci, are you in line, and did you hear the question? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Representative Sather, then Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, Bob, to keep you there. Can you give us some historical perspective? Right now we hear that about 33 of the 4,100 guardsmen in Alaska might be affected by this. Is that a high number historically, a low number? Is there a trend? What can you help us, what can you give us to help us understand the historical trend?
To the Chair, we have no access or visibility on this data at DMVA of what Alaskans are affiliated with National Guards outside. It would be very speculative of me to opine on that. We know that occasionally, like the examples from my own life I shared with you, there are points where individuals are drilling and affiliated with a different state than which they're residing, but I can't responsibly give you a number or a trend.
Then if I'll follow up with a more subjective question, do you think that the interstate transfer process tends to benefit Alaska? Are we the recipient or the sending guard unit? Is this a generally a good thing for Alaska, or do we tend to lose people?
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, I think overall we gain. A military spouse comes up to Alaska. That family decides they want to stay in Alaska. We gain. We get the experience of what they got outside, whatever training someone else sunk into them, what money was already spent on them in training. We get them much more ready to go. I recognize Alaskans leave, but I think on balance we sign more interstate transfers, bringing folks in than we do going out.
President Sanders,
thank you. And most of these good folks end up living in Chugaki River, for which we're very, very grateful. Mm-hmm. And the other question I was going to say is,
I'll let you think about that, Representative Ledoux.
So, Commissioner Dahl, is just a regular drill weekend active state service?
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, no, it is not. For that regular drill weekend, they're doing that pursuant to United States Code Title 32, where the federal USERRA protections would be in place to protect them from adverse employment actions for their participation or affiliation with the Guard.
So can I just follow up on that?
Follow up.
So how does the travel there play into things, either through this statute or the USERRA provisions? So in other words, you know, if you're living between Oregon and Washington and you need to be there over the weekend, that's like no big deal. But if you have a weekend drill in New York City and you're here in Alaska, that would probably necessitate leaving Friday morning and probably coming back to your work Tuesday morning. So is under this proposed bill or USERRA, are people protected for that time?
Through the Chair, from my own experience drilling in Newport News while living in Anchorage, my experience was Thursday night I was headed out and I was red-eyeing back Sunday afternoon, so I could show up in some form Monday morning for my regular full-time employer. In that scenario, USERRA, my understanding is USERRA does provide protections for the time reasonably necessary to get to and from drill as well as the drill itself. Now, in terms of doing right by your employer, you're also going to, most folks are going to find a way to, I'd say, make that up to them in terms of adjust their hours if they can work longer other days or other things so that the work gets done, too, to take care of that extra day. Everything isn't prescriptive. Part of that is just two people talking, and usually you work that out because if at some point a company can't accommodate you just because of that small business or the workload involved. You can't drive the company out of business with your military service either.
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
But is in under either USERRA or here, is there a provision that if you can't work it out, that somebody's protected?
Through the chair. So the question, as I understand it, is your job protected if the company cannot accommodate your travel schedule?
That's correct.
And I believe there are exceptions under USERRA for that scenario. We have not had this issue come up in state active duty in Alaska where we have had to get the matter adjudicated. It is not spelled out by regulation. We would, and I think litigation would be involved to determine the intent behind the language and how it was interpreted to address that scenario, and they would look to the federal law, the federal implementation as an example under USERRA.
But just a follow-up here. People, if they're going to their drills, are protected by USERRA, and the travel time would be protected by USERRA also. The state wouldn't get involved in.
Through the chair, that's
just go into your drill.
That's correct. That's reasonable travel time, which should be protected under USERRA along with the drill weekend itself.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Did you think of your question?
Yes, it is.
Representative Sadler.
Through the chair, Mr. Dole. I was just going to try to ask a few questions just to elucidate what being called to active state duty might be. That's like when the Mississippi River floods, the Mississippi Guard, you know, lays sandbags. You mentioned that there's a tremendous snowfalls at Alaska Guard. Called to state service might go. A less fortunate situation was when the Ohio Guard was called up to Kent State in 70. But those are called to active state duty in comparison to being federalized, which means you're going to Afghanistan.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's my understanding as well.
Any further questions? Any other discussion? Okay. Thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner. I appreciate it. Okay. Before we close, I just want to thank the committee for allowing me the opportunity to be able to introduce legislation on behalf of the committee. I want to spread the honor and the recognition for the work that we're going to be doing. I think that we're going to be doing some good work here. I really appreciate the relationships that we're forming, and I expect us to be doing good things on behalf of our military service members and veterans. And I also want to thank the committee for being on time. That really means a lot to me. I appreciate that. And so our next meeting will be held on Tuesday, January 31st, starting at 1 p.m. And we stand adjourned at 2:26 p.m.